Well, beloved listeners, Angkor in modern day Cambodia was the largest pre-industrial city on Earth. It covered 1,000 square kilometres, pretty much the size of modern day LA. Over a whopping five centuries, it grew to a megacity with over 1,000 temples. And then by 1431, it was abandoned. And no one quite knows why. It's a mystery. Well, now researchers at Sydney Uni think they may have worked out what happened. And sitting with me in the studio, Associate Professor Dan Penny. Dan, welcome.
Thank you.
Set the scene for us. Please describe Angkor's structural layout.
I guess the first thing to note about Angkor is that it's quite different from what we might normally think of as a medieval city in the European sense, which are quite small, compact, high density.
And very high dense populations.
Yes,
people don't realise that, do they?
Very
in the
dense
ancient world, you had population densities worthy of Manhattan.
Indeed. And so the notion of a compact, high density and bounded urban environment doesn't apply at Angkor at all. It is a sprawling city, much more akin to the sprawling cities of the modern day, cities like Los Angeles and Sydney, where they are fundamentally low density and very, very, very large. So you mentioned that Angkor covers an area of about 1,000 square kilometres, which does make it the largest pre-industrial city on the planet. And its layout was essentially defined by two things, one of which is a very elaborate system for managing water flow across the landscape.
And there is still clear evidence of that, of course, isn't there, with the dikes, weirs, dams, storage reservoirs.
Absolutely.
Incredibly impressive.
Yeah, all of these things form a network of infrastructure for managing water flow. And of course, that's a preoccupation of the Khmer because they live in a very seasonal environment where you either have to manage too much water or too little. So this urban infrastructure designed to manage water became a kind of defining characteristic of the function and the form of the city as it grew.
Did it have a sewage system?
No, not in the sense that we recognise from, say, for example, Rome, where you have much higher densities of people and where the disposal of human waste is much more of a problem. This is a low-density city which is composed of both residential settlement and agricultural land uses, and they are mixed together. So if you can imagine something like the fringes of a modern Australian city, so the disposal of, for example, human waste generally proceeded by burying that material in pits. We have that information from observation from a Chinese visitor in the end of the 13th century.
We've talked population densities elsewhere. What was, do you think, the population of Angkor at its height?
It's very difficult to know. There are no direct historical records that would help us conclude the total population of Angkor, but the best we can guess is that about 750,000 people.
Wow.
Yes, it was very large. It was very populous.
One of the things I didn't know was that there would have been a lot of smoke in the air. Tell the listener why.
Yeah, I think if you were to transpose yourself back to Angkor in 1297 or thereabouts, the first thing you would notice would be the smell of fire, domestic fires, industrial fires. Of course, the economy was fueled not on coal or renewables, but on charcoal, and there was a whole industry in producing that. So the first thing you would notice, I think, is the smell of almost continuous burning.
Of baking wood in underground ovens.
Yeah, so the charcoal that is used in domestic fires or industrial fires is produced, there's a whole industry around procuring that wood, high calorific value wood, and converting it into charcoal and then selling it on for domestic use.
What makes the place fascinating to me, or even more fascinating, is that Hindu, Buddhist, king worship and animism all had their influence.
Indeed, and they quite happily coexist in many instances. Certainly the traditional animist beliefs of the Khmer sit very comfortably with state-level religions, and there was much more conflict between Buddhism and Hinduism during the course of Angkor's growth. But always this deep animist belief in local spirits has always sat very comfortably with these state religions.
Well, we see that, of course, surviving in Bali, don't we?
Yes, indeed, of course, yeah, that's right.
No money. So what, a barter economy?
Yes, effectively. Much of the wealth of the state was procured by way of tithes and taxes, effectively, from the residential population who are busily growing things. And that was centralized and collected by the temples, the state-level temples. And so we have these fabulous inscriptions which record lists of goods and materials and people associated with particular temples. These were incredibly wealthy institutions that were harnessing, gathering and collecting materials from the landscape that were effectively taxes imposed on the populace.
There are parts of the area where, of course, the jungle has virtually reclaimed the temples, where trees writhe and, in a sense, both hold up and rip apart ancient temples. Angkor itself has been extensively restored, hasn't it?
Yes, it has.
Particularly after some of the pillaging and destruction caused by Pol Pot and the boys.
Indeed. There are a few temples, actually, that have been left in the state in which they were initially rediscovered by the French, only a few notable ones. The reconstruction of the temples has been the primary focus of archaeologists and art historians for more than a century, of course, and the temples are extraordinary and spectacular and really quite remarkable achievements of architecture and art. And so it's hardly any surprise that they have drawn the attention of people that work at Angkor and visit there.
Talking to Dan Perry. Dan, let's look at some of the theories of why people left. Before we get on to yours, tell me about the theories of the invasion of the neighbours.
Yeah, this arose, I think, from historical accounts, both Thai and Khmer, that emerged sometime between the 16th and 19th centuries, well after Angkor was abandoned, which attribute the demise of the city to a violent invasion, a sack of the city by a neighbouring state out of the city of Ayutthaya in modern-day Thailand. And so this happened notionally around 1431.
But there's no evidence of this, no physical evidence.
No, despite there being more than a century of really meticulous archaeology, there's no evidence of caches of unburnt or unburied bodies. There are no caches of weapons. There's no structural evidence of a siege. There is some evidence of the fortification of some of the temple enclosures, but certainly nothing that would indicate a violent sack of the city. This has become lodged in the historical narrative around Angkor's demise, and it's very hard to lever it out despite the fact that the historical evidence is very flimsy and the physical evidence is lacking entirely.
Dan, there's another theory that people moved to the coast to get involved in trading.
Mm-hmm. Angkor has always been connected to trade networks. In fact, the Khmer were trading with India and China in the centuries BC. So there's always been connections to trade.
Trading what, might I ask?
All sorts of goods were exchanged from elephants to rare timbers were exchanged between Cambodia and China and India. All sorts of materials were flying around the world, and they were trading as far as the Middle East and Europe as well. What we have, I think, as Angkor grew and became older and more established, was the emergence of a more vibrant international trade network, what the historian Anthony Reid calls the Age of Commerce. And so there was perhaps more opportunity to make money or to a more return on investment in smaller, more nimble trading centres closer to the action, as opposed to this vast, sclerotic agricultural centre, which is a long way inland, despite being connected to these trade networks.
Okay, another theory reminds me of what happened to the great era of pyramid building in Egypt, and that is that pyramids became ever more grandiloquent, they took ever more effort, they exhausted what was left of the economy, and finally they didn't even work, and they didn't really preserve the the Pharaoh, hence the Valley of the Kings and hiding them. And there is an argument that the king of Angkor went on such a building spree that it exhausted the population.
This was King Jayavarman the Seventh, perhaps the best known and the most famous of the kings of Angkor, who didn't go on quite a spree of building monumental architecture. And that had certainly ground to a halt by 1295 as the last temple that was consecrated at Angkor. And after that time, nothing happens, effectively. And our vision, our historical record disappears. We have no inscriptions, no new monumental building. And the suggestion has always been that this building orgy was at such a pitch and for such a long time that it effectively exhausted resources and exhausted the population. In parallel to that is the rise of Theravada Buddhism, of course, which is much less prone to the sort of self-aggrandizing monumentalism of the Khmer kings when they were Hindu kings. So it is a fundamental change in the approach to kingship and leadership, I think.
I want to ask you a personal question, Dan. What do you think happened?
I think it's not a neat story, and that sounds right to me. I don't think that Angkor was sacked. I don't think that there was a vast and catastrophic migration of people out of Angkor as it was taken by the forces of Ayutthaya. I suspect there were a range of processes at work. Certainly, there was a lack of investment in Angkor. I think it had become large.
You mean other than in the buildings?
The investment in the buildings had begun to slow and stop. The infrastructure was enormous, sclerotic, and unstable. There was more return on investment in smaller trading centres elsewhere, so the elite were increasingly drawn away. I think that there's certainly tension with neighbours, but the coup de grace effectively for the city as a functional urban fabric came with climatic variability.
Well, I remember the last time I was there, there was an argument that climate change of sorts was the last of the nails in its coffin.
I think that's a nice way to put it, yes. There are other processes at work here, of course, but from the middle of the 14th century, we have a series of very long, very protracted droughts stretching into decades, interspersed with periods of quite intense rainfall. And so it's neither really the drought nor the flood which is doing the damage to Angkor, but the variability between them. And what we see in the remains of the city now is very clear evidence of catastrophic damage to the water distribution network, which effectively underpins.
Well, certainly those floods would have done a lot of damage.
Absolutely.
To the, the canal infrastructure.
That's exactly right. And it had become so large and so interdependent that even a small disruption to that system creates a cascading failure, which brings the whole system down effectively. And that's certainly what we see during the 14th and 15th centuries. But having said that, there are precursors. There is a clear indication that the elite were moving away from the core of Angkor some decades before those climatic variabilities began to manifest themselves.
And perhaps they were also becoming, in a cultural sense, much more agnostic.
That's absolutely right. Yes, I think that's very true. It's hard to deduce those things in the absence of a historical record. But there are clearly social processes, geopolitical processes at work here that are priming the city for a transformation. That transformation occurred, as it happens, as a result of a climate disruption. But there were important social processes at work here that made that situation possible.
So, as you put it, it's a transformation, not a collapse.
Yeah, it's a desire, I think, for us to see these things as neatly explained, either by the invasion of a foreign power or as a result of climate change. And to emphasize narratives around loss and failure and collapse. And in fact, what we're seeing at Angkor, I think, is much more of an adaptive response to changing circumstances. This is a conscious and deliberate transformation of the Khmer state, not a social or an ecological catastrophe. This is a transformation.
LNL on RN. You can download us wherever you get your podcasts or listen on the ABC Listen app. And sitting opposite me in the studio, Associate Professor Dan Penny from the University of Sydney. And Dan's trying to solve the mystery of what led to the demise of the ancient civilization of Angkor in modern-day Cambodia. In parenthesis, is it difficult to work in Cambodia?
No, I mean, we've been working there. The University of Sydney team has been working there in close collaboration with our Khmer colleagues now for nigh on 20 years, and it's been a very rewarding, productive collaboration. And we've been very welcomed to work there with our colleagues in Cambodia. It's becoming increasingly difficult to work there in recent times, but it has.
You were mentioning off air that there's an increasing sense of nationalism or national pride, and perhaps outsiders are seen as colonial.
Yeah, and not unreasonably so. This is we are dealing with Khmer cultural heritage. It is their cultural heritage, and it's perhaps understandable for all of us to empathise with the resistance to having foreign teams come in and work on your cultural heritage and report on it in their own ways, in their own mechanisms, and through their own medium. There's an understandable pushback against that kind of paternalism, I think.
Dan, is it a bit like Venice? Are tourists loving the place to death?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's certainly at times overrun by tourists. It is a spectacular place to visit, and it's perfectly understandable that there are millions upon millions of visitors each year. I think there are genuine concerns about the impact of the town which services the World Heritage Site. This is Siem Reap, which has a burgeoning population, of course, and which has a number of golf courses and hotels and all of these things to service the international tourist trade. There was some genuine concern about the drawdown of groundwater causing localized subsidence beneath the temples themselves in recent years. So managing the site is a challenge. The World Heritage Area, the World Heritage Site, is 400 square kilometres, which is less than half of the ancient city, of course, but is a massive area made up of many, many hundreds of monuments. It's an enormous challenge for the Cambodian government to manage this.
Dan, thanks for coming in. Fascinating. Associate Professor Dan Penny, another talent from the University of Sydney, and I think that was immensely helpful.